Coming up today, Amazon tries to get him young with an Echo for kids, and we look at some of the problems with how the world has responded to the Toronto attack. You're listening to episode 366 of the YGK Podcast, your weekly essential catch-up on all the big stories in technology, science, and business. This is the week when Google finally redesigned Gmail. Yep, Google's belatedly brought Gmail kicking and screaming into the modern email age. Changes include previews of attachments, a snooze button, and inline reminders to reply to emails. You'll start noticing the changes over the coming weeks.
It was also the week where Finland didn't pull the plug on its basic income experiment, despite what some reports said. So what did happen is that the Finnish government rejected a request to expand the limited experiment so it would include payments to employed people as well as unemployed people. But instead, the government said no, so the experiment will end as planned in January 2018. But don't worry, because Canada has a bigger and better universal basic income experiment underway.
It was also the week when Facebook's chief technology officer appeared in Parliament and faced the grilling from MPs. He admitted the company didn't read the terms of the app that harvested data of 87 million people for Cambridge Analytica and didn't tell the UK's data regulator when it found out the data had been taken.
And this is the week that Avengers Infinity War hits cinemas. Don't worry, there won't be any spoilers on this show. It's Marvel's much-hyped superhero showdown featuring all your favourite characters working together to thwart the evil Thanos. And Anne McCammon went to a preview screening. You can catch his relatively spoiler-free review on wire.co.uk now, and we'll have a more in-depth discussion on the website once more people have had a chance to see it next week.
And for more on all of those stories, check out the show notes on the podcast page of wired.co.uk. A slightly different intro. Well done, everyone. Let's jump into the facts. Well, let's introduce ourselves first. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Vicky Tuck.
Hi.
Matt Reynolds.
Hey.
Matt Burgess.
Hello.
We'll be smoother next time. Facts. What did you learn this week, Matt Burgess?
This week, I learned that in 2009, so we're going back a few years, a pigeon managed to carry data across South Africa faster than the internet could manage.
Lies.
No, this is true. This is true. This is something that I learned. Basically, that a IT company put an 11-month-old bird, they gave it a USB stick with 4 gigabytes of data, and basically tested it against one of their competitors' ability to run the internet.
Your internet connection is slower than a pigeon, Matt Burgess.
If you lived in South Africa in 2009.
Good to know.
And you used a certain carrier.
Matt Reynolds, save us.
So I learned that the Amazon Alexa is named after the Egyptian Library of Alexandria. And actually, it was also chosen because Alexa is, phonetically speaking, a very kind of distinct word to say. So there's not many words that you can mistake Alexa for. So it was chosen because it has this kind of like this L sound and this X sound. So it meant that it was very unlikely to be used to accidentally wake up the devices.
Long-term podcast listeners will remember that fact from a previous episode.
Are you kidding? This has happened again.
I was going to say, how didn't you know that from before?
Because I always listen to the Wire podcast, even when I don't work for this magazine.
Yeah, absolutely. You should. It's great. Vicky Turk, what did you learn?
I learned a rather disgusting fact this week. I learned just how filthy your phone is. It is unsurprisingly covered in bacteria. One study found that mobile phones carry 10 times more bacteria than most toilet seats. And various studies have found bacteria including E. coli, MRSA and Streptococcus, which are all quite nasty and can actually make you sick, and lots of other species living on your phone.
I disinfect my phone daily.
Well, this is what you're advised to do is... either use a microfiber cloth, which doesn't kill all bacteria, but is better than nothing, or an antibacterial wipe, which your phone maker will probably not be so happy about. But, you know, you've got to make trade-offs in life.
If you've cracked your screen, don't do it. If you've got a cracked screen, you'll ruin your phone. I learned that the highest value banknote still in circulation in the world is the United States $10,000 bill. This is an actual thing that actually happened. It was last printed in 1945 and officially discontinued in 1969, but it's still legal tender. And as of 2009, there were 336 still in circulation. And almost as weird, there are still thought to be 165,372 remaining $1,000 bills.
Wow.
It's really hard to break a $10,000 bill. You know, you
really
can't just buy a pack of chewing gum, can you?
Yes. It turns out that the era of very, very high denomination bills has been wiped out across the world when they went, hang on, that is just being used for money laundering.
Yeah.
That is all that it is. So a slightly different opening to the show, but we want to jump back to last week when Matt's, I challenged you and myself to use your phones less by tracking how much you use them. How did you get on? Matt Burgess, do you want to go first?
I'll go first. So this was using the app called Moment for people that weren't listening, and it was an app that has been used or has been created to sort of track how long you spend on your phone, sort of how many times you pick it up, like how many hours, sort of the apps you're using. And for the first 2 or 3 days, I was pretty shocked. I found that I was using my phone for like 3-4 hours a day, which alarmingly the app told me was 27% of my waking life, which is like the really scary thing. And then I actually managed to drop that from 4 hours a day to 0 because I got mugged and somebody took my phone, which is actually a really good way to beat smartphone addiction. Not good for crime stats, but...
Don't get mugged. We were sorry to hear your news, Matt Burgess. He's fine. He's fine. But the phone is at the moment lost somewhere in London.
It is, but I'm not using it. That's the main thing here. Exactly. I'm not addicted to it anymore.
Yep, there we go. Matt Reynolds, how did you get on?
So I averaged 2 hours and 8 minutes per day. Which is all right. I think that apparently the Moment app says the average user spends 3 hours and 57 minutes on their phone every day. I think maybe the people that install the Moment app are people that are worried about using their phone a lot. So I think perhaps that's a bit higher than, you know, than most people. But yeah, I feel all right. And what I was surprised at is on a general day, I pick up my phone 90 times, just checking out what's going on, seeing notifications. Oh, no one's WhatsApped me. It was my mum again. So yeah, 90 times. That's quite a lot to be, you know, picking it up.
I can beat that.
Go on.
Depressingly. I unlock my phone on average 100 times a day, sometimes slightly more. I think the other day it was 120, maybe a few more than that. But stupidly, I denied the app I used. I'm on Android, and I downloaded a similar app to Moment called Quality Time. And in my haste to not be stalked across the internet, I denied it permission to track my uses by individual apps or screen time because I'm a paranoid idiot. But it does tell me that I definitely flick my phone out of my pocket way too often and just hit the unlock key and look at nothing.
Yeah, that's the really amazing thing is that I found on Moment you can kind of go through and it tells you during the day what you've done, and it's got these little dots where you just kind of like, you know, open your phone, and you know, I would just find myself just, you know, unlock my phone, look at it, kind of forget why I'd actually kind of like done it, and then put it off again, and then literally do the same thing 2 minutes later on.
So are you going to keep using the app?
No, because I can't be bothered, because it's always like, oh, take a screenshot of your battery time. And I spend loads of time on Safari, 52 minutes on average a day on Safari. So I don't know what that says. But I don't know. I don't think that it's necessarily adding much.
Matt, even though with the mugging?
I'm not going to say that the app's fault was why I got mugged. But no, I'm probably not going to download it when I get a new phone.
Fair. I might go back and give mine the proper permission so I can get a better idea of how much time I'm wasting. So if you really want to know, tune in again next week and find out if I've managed to work out how Android's permission systems work. The answer is probably no. All right, we're finally on to our first story of the week. Matt, do you want to introduce this one or should I?
Yeah, no, I'll go for it. So this is a story about Amazon's new Echo Dot. So, you know, Echo Dot, it's that kind of that smart assistant speaker that runs Alexa. I'm sure you're pretty familiar with that. Basically, this week, Amazon just opened the pre-sale for the Echo Dot Kids Edition. So it goes on sale in the US only on May the 9th. And so what's different about the Echo Dot Kids? Well, on the surface, not an awful lot, right? It's rubberized. It's got a kind of child-friendly case around it, so you can probably drop it and get sticky hands and it'll be fine. It's brightly colored. But most of the main tweaks are this on the inside. So it's got stuff like access to kid-friendly audiobooks, it answers questions a bit differently, and it has kind of like automatically filtered music so it doesn't have swearing in. And this is basically all delivered through a thing called Amazon 3-Time Unlimited, which actually has existed for a little while in a free version, but I wasn't aware of it. And essentially this is a subscription service you can access kid-specific functions with. So it has stuff like curated age-appropriate books, age-related apps, radio station, premium skills that might be stuff like, oh, a SpongeBob alarm clock or something like that. And kind of TV shows as well. And basically, it's a little bit confusing how this is going to work, right? So we've got this Echo Kid, this Echo Dot Kids device. So you can kind of buy that, and then bundled with that, you can get Free Time Unlimited, which can be available as a standalone subscription. So it's $3 a month if you're a Prime member already. Or you can also get a kind of version for your existing Alexa app. There's a free version that has some less functionality, or you can subscribe to it as well. So not only is there going to be a specific kids-only version of the Alexa app, but you can also childify your existing device if you want.
But we didn't bring this on the podcast just to talk about it as a device. The thing that really struck us was this is a really, really big, bold play by Amazon. It already owns a huge chunk of this market for adults. And now it's gone, oh, hang on, there's all these little people too. And this is a big deal.
Yeah, exactly. And now I don't want to get too conspiracy theoried or too worried in advance, right? Because this hasn't been used and we're not really sure. And we know that children already use Alexa. So this is something they're already doing. It's just kind of... you're making advice more specifically, but I have to say I'm a little bit worried about the kind of platform getting a foothold on kind of children. And I think that there's maybe a bit of a problem when you create a product like Alexa that is so specifically aimed at children. It's trying to, it seems to me, kind of like, lock them in. If you look at what Amazon is doing, with kids, Siri doesn't have that. Cortana doesn't have that. Google Assistant doesn't have this kind of hold or this kind of ability to have a kind of a kid version of the app. And I think that what's worrying is, let's not forget what Amazon does, right? Amazon doesn't, as its primary business, it doesn't make tablets, or it doesn't make these kind of Echo devices. It sells stuff on Amazon, right?
Yeah,
that's where it makes the majority of the money. And actually it was the World Wide Web conference today, actually, and Amazon, one of their vice presidents, did a kind of talk, and they showed that a couple of things they're training Alexa to do, and one of those things is to kind of remember stuff, you could say. So you could say, Alexa, remember it's James's birthday on this day, and could recall that later on.
Yeah.
And another thing is stuff to for Alexa to kind of remind you to or kind of offer you product suggestions. If you say something like, Alexa, how do you get oil out of the carpet, or how do I get how do I brush my teeth, or whatever, something like that, and they'd say, oh, have you tried Tide, or have you tried Aquafresh? And I think this is the problem. This is a kind of platform that at the end of the day is probably trying to push us to buy more things through Amazon. And I think that's kind of worrying when, what does that mean when you have kind of children on that, and how is children's data going to be used to feed that end goal?
Yeah. So you said earlier, and I'd be interested to get everyone else's views on this. You said earlier that Microsoft hasn't done this with Cortana, Google hasn't done it with Home or Assistant or whatever, and Apple hasn't done it with Siri. But isn't it about time that they do? We can't be blind to the fact that children are using this technology and they're interacting with it and learning a lot with it. So it's high time that technology companies do build these things in super early on, rather than coming in a few years late with a YouTube version for kids, which is full of holes and problems. Just get out there early with a version for kids that they can use, and then the companies can start learning the best way for that technology to behave.
There have been, actually, some voice assistant devices designed for kids previously. There was one, I think it was a year or 2 years ago, by Mattel, the toy company, and that was called Aristotle, and it was supposed to be kind of educational, and it could play lullabies and things like that. But Mattel, the company, actually cancelled it because they got a lot of concerns about privacy from parents and from privacy activists and so on. And child psychologists also were concerned about whether this device could be used as sort of a replacement nanny. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of sort of furore around it when they tried to launch this sort of Amazon Echo for kids. So people have tried. There are a few issues as well from a technical standpoint with making these devices for kids. The most important one, I think, being that children's speech is hard to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you've ever tried to use kind of voice recognition software, but you'll find that if you've got a bit of an accent, or if you speak too fast, or you stumble over your words, it's not that great at transcribing what you're saying. And when you have children who often don't speak in proper sentences and maybe have, a bit of a mushy voice and don't properly enunciate, it's very hard to do that. So I'd be really interested, just on a technical level, to see how well Amazon can turn children's voices to text.
And I guess it will get better at this over time, right? The more children are speaking to it, and they must already have wealths of data from kids that have been speaking to the adult version of Alexa, and they can start to train it on. There must be consistencies, and there are consistencies in how children develop speech, and when they develop hard sounds and consonants and things like that, and when they stop kind of sliding over vowels in weird ways. So I guess with time it will get better, just as eventually it learned to understand British English as well as it could understand American English.
Yeah, but kids seem to love the Amazon Echo, and actually it's, I think, just across the whole of their marketing, it's done really well that they've called it Alexa, because you don't hear people calling it the Amazon Echo. You hear the limited amount of children that I spend time around And actually, I don't think any of us in here don't actually have any children. So we're probably coming from a bit of an outside perspective, but we all know children.
I know of children.
I've
met some a couple of times. But they absolutely love speaking to Alexa. Like around Christmas, there were so many, like the adverts particularly, were from Amazon, were all billing up, like kids asking where Santa is. And I spent Christmas with some children, and they were asking...
Sorry, you've managed to make this sound so suspicious.
I spent Christmas with some children. Just you and some children.
And an Alexa.
There was other family members were there. But all they wanted to do half the time was speak to Alexa. They had loads of toys, but they were like, oh, we want to ask Alexa to play this piece of music. We want to do this. And it really excites them. And that voice technology is something that kids can actually sort of really get on board with, I think, compared to a phone, which is they can stab at it and point and prod things and actually work their way around apps. But voice seems a lot easier, even if they haven't got the sort of vocabulary yet to use it properly.
And without wanting to sound too much like a marketing person for Amazon, it's interesting to see how differently children interact with Alexa and voice assistants in general compared to adults. So a friend of mine was saying the other day that her little kid takes Alexa food. So when she's allowed a snack, Alexa is allowed a snack, and she's taught to not treat it like some slave or servant, she speaks to it politely. And I think Amazon's built into the Alexa for Kids that if you say please, Alexa kind of responds in kind and you develop this nicer relationship with it. And while for an adult this might sound a bit weird, I think when we were talking about this story in the office earlier in the week when Amazon announced it, we were like, well, this has the potential to get kids away from screens. And if as adults we have concerns that the younger people in the world are spending too much time looking at screens, or hey, here's a way that maybe they don't look at screens and they still get to listen to music and play games and do whatever, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I don't know about whether the Amazon Echo is the right vehicle, and we don't know exactly how it's going to work yet, so it's hard to tell. But voice technology in general, I think, you know, if used right, it can have great promise for kids, because you're right, you know, currently our primary way of interacting with technology is through a screen. And that's a very passive way of engaging with things. You know, we've all seen kind of kids sat in front of an iPad watching YouTube videos one after the other. And it, you know, it's not necessarily bad for them, but it also doesn't always seem that fulfilling. Whereas voice is, you know, it's how we naturally communicate with each other. We speak to each other. And so if you can build voice tech into an environment, it's just a much more natural way for a kid to interact with technology while they're perhaps also, you know, doing something else, playing with construction toys, whatever. And so I think that, you know, used properly, it could actually be really beneficial and just make those interactions a lot more seamless and a lot more of a kind of active experience. And potentially, you know, we were saying there about kids learning to speak and their development. Maybe they could even be used to help teach children how to communicate and help them maybe understand how to respond to people. Maybe even, you know, if we think more about kind of the emotional aspect of these AI assistants, can we help kids to interact with technology in a way that helps them communicate with real people or with the real world?
Yeah, I had an imaginary friend when I was a kid. So why couldn't I have Alexa as a friend, I guess? I mean, it sounds weird to me as a kid that grew up in the 80s, but perhaps it isn't so weird now. And I think there's a tendency for people to react to this stuff in quite an alarmist way when you see change coming around. And, you know, you criticize maybe your parents who are in their 60s, 70s, 80s for the way that they react to the internet or smartphones. Don't then impose those same slightly alarmist reactions on the new technology coming over the horizon. And Matt Reynolds, you probably had the strongest feelings in this as it being a potentially bad thing for kids.
Yeah, I think my thing is that it goes back to what I was saying about Amazon. You know, what does Amazon do? It collects data on what you do in order to recommend you products that it thinks you will like. And I think it's kind of a little bit terrifying to think about, you know, so the youngest age that free time can be set for is 3. The first age group is like 3 to 6, I think. So imagine if you've got a child from the age of 3, by the time they hit a teenager, you've got 10 years of Amazon data knowing, I don't know, you know, your questions that you ask Alexa, like, Alexa, you know, what should I wear today? Or like, is it cool to like wear this thing or something? And I think that there are so many good potentials to kind of do these things and have great apps that help you learn or can help, you know, children communicate and do all these kind of great things. Fundamentally, what does Amazon exist to do? It exists to sell us things through the Amazon platform and exists to gather data that can help it do that. And I think that, don't forget, we're really at the kind of like beginning point of Alexa, and that to me seems like Amazon's endgame, right? So they make Kindles, but they don't make money off Kindle devices. They exist to sell us Kindle books. And I think it's a similar thing with Alexa. And I guess I'm a little bit worried about that. And can you ever trust a company where its motivation is that?
It was lovely playing with you, Jenny. Do you know that Tide Pods get your clothes cleaner than any other? Yeah.
Yeah, good time outside.
There's definitely a lot of responsibility that these companies have if they're targeting children. And I think we really need to hold them to very high standards. But aren't there like some regulations about how you can use children's data?
Regulations? Matt Burgess?
Vicky, you just saw me put my data protection hat on.
It's a mighty fine hat.
It's a bit like a wizard's hat, but slightly more dull. So, yeah, there are different, slightly different regulations for collecting data around children. And obviously GDPR, yes, sorry, you've had to mention it, is coming into play from the 25th of May. And that basically sort of states that there are stronger laws around collecting data of children. And if a company is relying on consent for collecting data, there is multiple ways that they can sort of justify collecting data, that people have to be, children have to be over the age of 13 to be able to provide consent under the law. So if you've got a young child, then they effectively need adults' permission to be sort of doing this. And
so you provide data. The consent for them?
Yes, effectively. But right. There are different ways to collect data, and the ways, legal ways for people to collect data. Consent is only one way. But also, interestingly, around this, well, it may not be interesting, but in a sort of converse way to this, WhatsApp this week in Europe raised the age that people can use it. So it was at 13 and now it's gone up to 16. And I'm not fully sure on what their reasons were for doing so, but I think it's data protection related and sort of stuff around GDPR as well. But it's sort of a different approach to sort of using a service like this. And obviously, actually, that children should be like really considering what they're using and what they're sort of doing, and their parents should have an input into this as well.
And there's a line from the notes that you picked out around marketing and the protections that children should have. So Matt Reynolds, your concern about an Echo building up this profile of data on a child for 10 years to market stuff, there does seem to be, even at this stage, some protections against that.
Yeah, so under GDPR and also sort of electronic marketing rules, which I'm not even going to go into, but children do merit like specific protection when personal data is being used to market to them. So it'll be interesting to see if Amazon can actually sort of, if it does market things to children using these devices and builds up data profiles and stuff like that, which I don't think it does a huge amount of at the moment because it's not quite personally specific enough. But if they do in the future, then there's probably going to be different sort of hurdles and steps that they have to get over.
So I mean, it's super early days yet, but there has to be a value for Amazon in collecting this detail and making this product, because as with all of their hardware devices, they sell them at such a low price, and even the subscription to the software is so low that it's all in the data. It's all in getting people to buy more stuff from Amazon. So how that plays out over time, we'll see. And it might be that the device isn't particularly popular, but you get the idea that based on how popular the Alexa for adults has been, it's probably going to sell quite well.
Yeah, and again, I don't want to sound like I'm a conspiracy theorist here, although I am. But I guess like sometimes you might compare it, and I know, James, you were saying earlier that, well, you kind of like, you know, we've had an iPhone and we've had all these devices that, you know, can be used by kids and that thing. But I think that I kind of find, you know, Alexa a bit of a paradigm shift, right? And the whole, you know, Echo series of objects, because this is an always-on microphone that is always listening to everything you do. And also that's true of the camera device, you know, the Echo Look or Show, whatever it is. And I just think that there's a different kind of like data collection where you might be using the YouTube app, and you might be like searching, or it might be when you're using your iPhone. I think that actually we should just be pretty wary when there's a new device, and you should kind of like think about the shift that it represents. You know, we invited these always listening microphones in our homes to listen to children, and that's not a new product, right? That's like a huge paradigm shift in how we are, you know, surveilled or how devices are used.
To be clear, they're not always listening. Only when the light is on, once they've heard their wake word, are they listening? The microphones are actually mechanically disconnected when the light's not on.
I thought it was that they were always listening, but they weren't always recording, so it wasn't always processing what you were saying, but it was always listening out.
Yeah,
for the
okay. So I guess it depends what you mean by listening. But they're not kind of streaming the sounds of your house to the cloud.
Yes, not yet. Anyway,
take your tinfoil hat off, Matt Reynolds.
Off. Goodness me. So in a room full of people that don't have children, would anyone buy this for the child in their life, whoever they may be? Or would they disapprove of other people buying them for their kids?
I'd potentially buy one for my niece. But, you know, then I know that her mother, my sister, would also kind of supervise how it was used. And, you know, I think, you know, with any new technology or any toy even, that is a crucial part. Like, there's definitely a large onus on the creators of the product to take children's needs into account. And obviously, safety is absolutely paramount. But, yeah, I think used in the right ways, you know, technology can do great things. We love technology. We're wired.
Conspiracy Reynolds is obviously going to say no, no way.
I have an Alexa, and I just think, you know, if it's good enough for me, it's good enough for my non-existent children. So I'd be up for it.
Yeah. I'd assume that with the kids' version, it's more designed to go into their bedrooms, potentially, because most children, I imagine, have already interacted with Alexa. The Echo will be in a living room or a kitchen or something like that, whereas the new one is meant for the bedroom. And then...
Sorry.
Yes. But, devices, particularly in children's bedrooms, I don't know.
And it's up to people to make individual decisions. No one's being forced to buy this product. But what I would say is, Vicky, you mentioned super early on when we were talking about this, when Mattel did it a few years ago, I would much, much prefer... Would I? No, I ain't going to say this. I would prefer Amazon to be the processor of that data than Mattel, just in terms of the security practices and the oversight of a company of that scale, when we're all quite clear on what they're doing. Whereas we've seen with lots of these connected smart toys for kids that they can be hacked to turn into swearing, stabbing, racist, mad machines, right? So at least with this, there was a little cute robot that you could train to just stab frantically and swear at you. So, you know, there's a certain degree of greater oversight when Amazon is involved. So there we go. Our second story this week is a bit of a departure. On Monday, 10 people were killed when a van was driven down a pavement along Yonge Street in the North York district of Toronto. On his Facebook page, the man accused, 25-year-old Alec Minassian, apparently linked himself to a group known as incels, or self-proclaimed involuntary celibates. The media has responded with a wave of articles seeking to explain Minassian's actions and his apparent link to this movement or group. It's a big story this week, and here's the question. How should we respond to attacks of this nature when there is so much online about their apparent ideology and motivation? How much should we normalize or publicize or mainstream, and how much should simply be left in the shadows, if you like?
So I guess what you're getting at here is that a lot of reporting around this event has kind of picked up on this apparent link to the so-called incel community. And in doing so, it's kind of explaining what that community is and what their ideology is. And questioning whether it is a good idea to potentially risk spreading these harmful views further by doing so.
Yes. So a writer for us, Nicole Kobe, spent some time looking into this and comparing it to how we respond to when an attack is carried out by someone with links to the so-called Islamic State. And the reasoning that we put forward there, and that some researchers who we spoke to put forward, was that you'd never seek to explain the ideology of the people that carried out those attacks. So why is there this keenness to have explainer articles, to have videos that go into detail on this ideology, on this way of thinking, as a way of perhaps not justifying, but seeking to explain the reasoning behind this attack, alleged reasoning behind this attack?
And we should say that this incel ideology is rooted in misogyny. It is basically hatred of women.
Yeah, so without wanting to be hypocritical, we're not going to explain it in detail on this podcast. And as we've explained, there's plenty of places that are willing to explain it online. I think what we're alarmed about is the level of detail and linking out to areas of the internet where you wouldn't normally go as a quote-unquote normal user of the internet. And this is, the word is mainstreaming. It's taking very, very fringe, dangerous views and plopping them on the front pages of some of the world's most popular and respected publications. And it's been quite weird to see.
Yeah, and I think, like, to sort of, again, not to explain it, but the movement of the group that is the community, to use a social media word, of incel has actually sort of grown quite a lot through social media, through 4chan, through 8chan, through Reddit, and through other online communities. And that's part of the reason why we're talking about that now, because actually, is it a case of this community growing and sort of these views being sort of spread more widely because they're on social media and other sort of online digital platforms? compared to before, when people couldn't necessarily find like-minded people or people who would be sort of susceptible to sort of more extremist or more extreme views, I would say. And that's, I think that's an important point about this story and the sort of alleged connections to the incident in Toronto, that a lot of this sort of spread through online behaviour.
Yeah, and what we saw in the aftermath of the attack is Reddit banned another incel subreddit, but it's not the first one it's shut down. It's shut down a number of them over the years, and Reddit certainly has some questions to answer about how it lets these controversial, not controversial, downright dangerous views be shared and spread on its platform. But then the media also has questions to answer about when it then decides to delve into those platforms and start reporting on what it finds. And there's not necessarily the benefit that some people might think there is in bringing those views into the public realm. And our reporter found that on sort of the self-proclaimed one of the leading forums for the incel community, I think there was something like 111 users with accounts logged into that site and thousands of guests. And they were setting up threads saying, you know, welcome, here are our views, here's our ideology. I'm trying to, you know, coax people into this community. And people that wouldn't normally have been exposed to those views suddenly are. And while the vast, vast majority of us will see them as utterly abhorrent and bizarre, some people might be tempted by that ideology.
Yeah, and I wonder, I mean, some of the point that Nicole made in the piece, was that, you know, this is, like Vicky, you said, this is like misogyny and hatred and terrorizing women in particular, and that it shouldn't take that, you shouldn't wait until that becomes associated with a particular group that self-identify by under whatever label. You know, if people are being hateful towards particular people, especially if that, you know, they're promoting violence and all this stuff, you know, that's what... you know, they're the kind of like grounds for getting rid of it, right? That's when Reddit acts, and not when it becomes a identifiable movement or that type of thing. You know, this is, yeah, I think kind of like how Nicole put it was, these aren't our words, but it's kind of like a, you know, it's a new ugly mask of a thing that has always been shape-shifting and is driven by the same kind of disgusting hatred and irrationality. So I wonder, you know, it's all about, you know, identifying that as opposed to thinking like, oh, it's a new thing.
Yeah, I mean, she makes a point, and you made it there, that, you know, misogyny is by no means new, unfortunately. It's been around pretty much forever. And, you know, the idea that these kind of internet communities are a new thing, it's just sort of the same old misogyny dressed up in different clothes. But I don't know. I have to say I am a bit conflicted on this one. I don't know what the best way to act is. And I do think that although misogyny has been around for long before the internet, I do feel like it spreads differently online. And I do think that online communities are a bit different to offline communities around these kind of extremist topics. You see these movements, and incels isn't the only one. There's several others in what's called kind of, I think people call it the manosphere, this kind of general misogynist group. And they tend to consist of kind of silos of people who all share the same views and just reinforce each other. And I think that this can tend to lead towards increasingly extremist views, because if all you've got is that community of people who share the same negative views and they're just constantly backing each other up and you don't hear alternate voices, I think that can potentially be more damaging than if you've just got this kind of general misogynist group, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, these groups, they have their own terminology, they've got their own vocabulary, and I think all of that kind of, you know, makes people find like they are, feel like they are not alone, and that actually there are other people who share these views, and it connects people who perhaps may not have found those other people before,
and certainly not found them completely in isolation and concentration, right? So part of this incel movement has come out of other movements which were, not to want to put a label on them, but less extreme, and their views weren't as violent and weren't as misogynistic, and they kind of stepped it up.
I mean,
as
they're
they
all
go.
Part of the same problem. Yeah, but I mean, it's the same with anything on the internet, and we've seen this with you know, discussions around fake news, for example. The more extreme views tend to get the greater mileage online, because you know, they're sensationalistic, they make you want to react whether you agree or not. And so I do think that internet communities can push people to these extremes. And, you know, I don't know. I think things spread differently online.
And I think it's part of that, the media, and not to get all high and mighty because we're part of it, but the media does have a tendency when a major event breaks like this is, how do we cover it? What's our angle? What can we do? And very often that angle is an explainer, just to go after some of the key terms that people are picking up on, hearing, maybe seeing crop up on Twitter and Facebook, and well, probably not Instagram, but they're hearing it round and about. And so you have very, very prominent, respected news sites going in and explaining the incel ideology. And very often these articles are written very earnestly, but they're not really written with an understanding of what putting those views out there could do. And I think the right way to look at it, and this is how Nicole and the researchers she put it, is you would definitely wouldn't do that with the so-called Islamic State. So why have we started doing it with this? It's really, really strange to see, because it's what they want. It's what these kinds of movements want. They want to go more mainstream. They want more people to join their fight as they see it.
Yeah, and I think it's a difficult one, because I think it is really important to understand where these communities are coming from and where this violence is coming from in order to address it. You know, certainly for people trying to stop this kind of behaviour, they need to have a thorough understanding of what's going on. But I also think with these online communities, you need someone who has the background to really understand what's going on, not only to get through the kind of terminology and the ideologies that are shared on these sites, which are often very specific, but also to understand the internet. Because when you see some of these things, there's lots of things like trolling going on. There's lots of internet-specific behaviours that still a lot of people don't really understand. If you don't live your life online in that way, you don't necessarily get the subtext or the context of conversations all the time. And so I think it's really important that we make sure we go to the right experts and the right researchers who can break through that and critique these things in a useful way.
Yeah, and it all comes down to sort of internet culture, I think, in a lot of cases, because it's as you were saying, it's not black and white, as it were. It is, there are subtleties, different contexts, different things that are sort of being spread, whether it's in a really group with sort of extreme views such as this, or a completely innocent group of people that are, I don't know, expressing their love for polo or something like that. They're like, the online communities work different to offline communities, and actually, like, there are similarities across all types of groups, but it's when you get to that line where these views become illegal or abhorrent or sort of very against the law. That's basically
it comes down to the legality of it, doesn't it?
I think that actually, like you were saying, Vicky, like knowing more about this, it helps us contextualize, because this isn't something that is unique to a small section of the internet. The normalization of hatred towards women. We literally have we don't have a president, but there is a president who boasts about sexually assaulting women. That, you know, what more expresses normalization of hatred and misogyny than that? And I think that, you know, if there's a takeout, it's all about, you know, collectively, how do you kind of like do more to stop hatred across the board, wherever it occurs? And that actually we like to think that there's this like, oh, there's this, you like, you know, this unique weird sect of these horrible people. And yeah, that is all true. They're weird and horrible, but you know, it's not a million miles away from things that are happening in open in the real world that are disgusting as well. And I think that, you know, there's a temptation to kind of like other all this stuff and not think about, well, what does this say about how I'm reporting, who I'm reporting on, the voices I'm doing, and all this stuff. So maybe it's like we all need to be more critical, like, of ourselves, as opposed to saying like, God, they're weird, I'm glad they're over there on 4chan.
I
think you're exactly right, and I think the point you make there is so important. It's so easy to jump to the stereotype that the people who have these kind of views are like, you know, the typical basement dwelling spot ridden man who, you know, has never had a girlfriend. And actually these views, or, you know, variations on these views, maybe not quite as extreme, are widely shared, you know, and lots of people maybe sympathize with at least aspects of it. These men are walking around doing normal jobs. They are normal people. And I think, yeah, to kind of suggest that they're like, just, oh, they're just sectioned over there, they are not like the rest of us, isn't necessarily the best way to see what's going on. And you know, you also make the point there that obviously violence against women is generally seen in different ways and reacted to in different ways to any other form of extremism because of, you know, deep-rooted kind of general sexism in the world.
And maybe a historical case that we can draw to, even though it was on a very different ideological grounding, is the Unabomber. So this was the case of a man in the United States in the 1970s who sent explosives to various officials and members of the press, and killed a number of people. And he managed to, in order to stop him from carrying out his attacks, his manifesto was published in full in some of the most high circulation publications in the United States. And when those views were shared, he became a figurehead for this way of thinking and believing. And back then it was hugely, hugely controversial that that manifesto was published. And unwittingly, it seems like over the past week, maybe not to the same extent, or maybe further, we have published not the manifesto in their words, but a version of it as seen through our eyes. And that is really, really problematic. And again, I bring it back to the example of the so-called Islamic State. We don't publish their views for our eyes. We just point out that what they believe in is abhorrent and give a very, very top level understanding of why they've acted in the way they did. And I think the last thing, and this kind of brings us back to the community and seeing people as separate from the rest of society, is the idea that this was a lone wolf attack, that these people come from nowhere. But online, they come from very, very strong communities.
Yeah, I think I kind of like touched on that a little bit when I talked about, you know, how they're, you know, the one arm of what exists in the mainstream anyway. But I think that's right, is that actually there's this idea that kind of like, oh, there's this kind of like, there's this lone wolf attack and it was someone that doesn't represent views that can exist anywhere else. But the point is, like you said, James, there are forums where these people exist. There are kind of communities of people that like self-reinforce these kind of beliefs. And maybe when they see stuff in the outside world of misogyny, they think like, that must mean there's people in the real world that believe this as well. And I think that, you know, writing some off as a lone wolf attack says more about the society from you which you come from to say like, oh, it can possibly be something that we could do. And I think that actually acknowledging that there are communities that do this, how do we stop them, how do we maybe even like, you know, reach out and try de-radicalize essentially, and then how do you stop people being radicalized who are, you know, less on the fringes of society. So it's, you know, if anything, hopefully it just turns the attention both on that those bits where, you know, there's radicals, and also on this bit where there's, we can stop people sliding that way. So yeah. Hopefully more can be done.
I mean, frankly, we live in a world where misogyny and violence against women is tolerated and accepted, and is it really a surprise that some people maybe take that a bit too far?
And we hope you enjoyed the slightly different format that we've brought in this week. We're going to be making some more changes. This is all based on the great feedback that we got from all of you out there on the survey that we released about a month ago. We got loads and loads of really great responses, so we really appreciate people taking the time to do that. We're going to be making some more changes, tidying things up here and there. We're trying to do a lot more work on the show notes, but there's some technical problems in the back end with how we push them out to you. Hopefully this week they'll be a little better than last week, and we'll make them a lot better in the coming weeks. So we'll leave it there for this week, and we'll see you again same time, same place next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.